Episode 1, it's a pilot. Flux capacitors, Heisenberg compensators, and let's get Thor's shirt off.
Visual effects, the craft of storytelling, and the people who make magic for screens both big and small. Hosted by showbiz veterans and new media entrepreneurs, Sean Apple, PJ Foley, and Ephraim Patel.
Hello and welcome to the first episode of this podcast, the presently unnamed podcast with myself, Ephraim Patel.
I'm Sean Apple.
And I am PJ Foley.
And the three of us together are this podcast, but we have yet to know or to figure out what this podcast is called or even about.
But it'll probably change your life anyway.
It's going to be life changing,
right?
And with that amazing description and title, we have nailed the perfect audience of people who are interested in hearing a podcast that doesn't know
you didn't
what
realize
it's doing.
We were doing better when we were fucking around.
Yeah. Just maybe.
All right. Well, here. I'll throw in a little background. How's that?
Okay.
Okay. All three of us are in showbiz. We're post-production guys, writers, directors.
We work in Hollywood.
Actors. Yeah, some Hollywood shit going on right here.
Both sides of the hill, you know what I'm saying.
That's right. Yep. On K Street. Oh, that's a different business. Not really. Oh. It's actually the same business. That was a Washington, D.C. reference.
Oh.
K Street's where all the lobbyists there.
Jordan.
Anyone?
Yeah.
Anyone?
I'm with you.
Okay.
Are you?
I'm not really.
That was a short-lived series, I believe.
It was. K Street.
K Street?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That was a George Clooney thing. So what do we... We want to talk about showbiz stuff and probably weighted pretty heavily with visual effects and how the business really works. So if you're in school trying to learn how to do this, first of all, move to Canada. Second of all, get out of the business if you don't want to move to Canada. No, I'm not. Am I really being down?
Yeah,
no,
you're going to start there.
No, but seriously, we have a lot of experience, but amongst the three of us, a lot of boutique experience. I don't know. Has anybody worked at a big shop like ILM?
Digital Domain.
Oh yeah. Okay. DD. Yeah. All right.
I almost took a job at ILM.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. Yeah.
We don't have a fridge now.
Yeah.
The biggest joint I've worked for is probably Zoic or Foundation, one of the whatever. So,
and if you haven't heard of any of these companies, it's a good chance they've gone under.
Yeah.
Oh, Zoic's still around.
Zoic's still around. Foundation though
hasn't been around for a long time.
I worked for Computer Cafe, one of the ill-fated ones.
Right.
And now there's computer cafes everywhere. Every coffee shop you walk into.
Pretty terrific. Yeah.
Well, yeah. Then it became Cafe Effects, but I actually worked for the Syndicate, which was their more ad agency division. But very quickly, and not long term at all, because then I went and took a producer job.
Was that the Vegas excursion?
No, that was post Vegas.
Oh, okay. Where was that?
Where was which? The producer job?
Yeah,
that was UFO film. So I learned even more about the seedy underbelly.
So let's talk about seedy underbelly and UFO for a second.
Okay.
So if you guys are, first of all, if you watch the Sci-Fi Channel or anything like that, you've seen a lot of the pixels that we put up on the screen.
Yeah.
The Monster of the Week.
Monster of the Week stuff, exactly.
Yeah.
There's rarely a day that something I did not touch is not on the Sci-Fi Channel.
There you go.
Something you did not touch. You're employing triple negative.
Yeah.
I'm lost.
I'm saying it's all there all the time.
Right.
Less and less lately, just because the shows are getting old. But yeah, almost every day, something I worked on is on the Sci-Fi Channel.
You know what's kind of fun about UFO, though, is that... I don't know if UFO started this. This probably goes back to Ed Wood or whatever and Roger Corman. But the cool idea now that is now becoming, that's coming back around as a thing with Sharknado and like everybody's like owning the kitsch now of it. And they're just like, well, shit, let's just go for it.
Well, they've jumped the shark with Sharknado because now it's Sharknado Week on Sci-Fi Channel.
Oh, is it really?
So they took their own Shark Week.
And jumped their own.
Yeah, made it Sharknado Week.
Well, that's a rift in time and space.
It was Roger Corman, right, that did the first Sharknado? Or am I thinking Sharktopus?
Yeah. Sharktopus.
Okay.
So that kind of got that craziness rolling, though, right? When it was. Was that the obviously stupid.
Yeah, that was the dive right in and really do it kind of moment. There were super combo animal kind of things on the periphery, but mostly it's like add a robot to a snake.
Were they trying to be serious, or did they kind of know that whatever they're, it was winking at the audience?
If the honest truth is, on the shows I worked on, they always come out with it depends kind of how the director and the producer synergy starts, and then they try to decide on a tone. It's like, oh, this is going to be funny, or can we make it funny? And then the executives will say, yeah, we're with you, you can do that. And they're, all right, so it's going to be a little campy, there's going to be some jokes, yeah, we're with you, you can do that. And then they approve a script, something's going to change, bunch of stuff gets cut, it's not so funny anymore. But the executives, I don't know, just don't come out and say, we don't want funny, until you're shooting or right. until you're cutting. And then they're like, no, this is an action film. It's action all the way through now. So what, you got to cut some jokes and stuff. Everyone's got to, you know, the actors don't look serious in these parts.
Do you think but, this
yeah,
is...
Yeah, well, we thought we were going to be funny.
So do you think this is a matter of like... they keep changing the goal because they keep falling short of what the previous goal was? Like, it's not really that funny. Okay, it's an action movie now. Yeah, it's an action movie. And then it's like, well, it's not all that action oriented. It's like, but it's camp, you know? Is it like... So it's like, it's not a commitment problem, but it's a, it's well, like they didn't nail it. So they're going to weasel out of that and do something
instead
else.
Of a really strong voice. I think they were paying attention a lot of times to ratings.
Oh, and what was, and just check. That
and
makes sense.
Yeah.
For
like
money.
Literally they can minute to minute kind of look at ratings when people are tuning in and tuning out of a movie while it broadcasts.
Right.
Thereabouts. It's not real time. Maybe it is now. I don't know. But they would really mark ratings to moments in a script or moments in an edit. And whatever was good, just do more of that. So if there was a really bloody scene in an alligator movie, they're going to think, oh, they like really bloody scenes. Or, oh, they really like alligators. So let's do more gators.
Right.
Let's do more blood.
You know, this reminds me a little bit of, do you remember those things when you were a kid where it was like, it was a book and it was cut into thirds? There was a top third, a middle third, and a bottom third. There's the eyes and then the nose and the mouth, and you flip through and you change. That to me is how these movies are made. It's like, no, not that one, that one. And or like in the testing phase, it's like, well, they really like the Frankenstein nose. So all of them from here are not going to have the Frankenstein nose, you know?
Yeah, it seems like there's that going on. And correct me if I'm wrong, PJ, but it also seems like there's a real sense of like, how can we do this as cheaply as possible, as quickly as possible? So you've got scripts that are rushed through that are, you know, written by what seems like potentially amateurs, and it's the first pass. And it gets approved and then greenlit, and they're shooting in Romania or Bolivia or wherever. and then, you know, so it seems to me when you get to the editing phase, when they're actually seeing things start getting rough together and they're starting to lose confidence maybe in the comedy or this or that, they're also not, maybe it's not landing because it wasn't done well, but also those things oftentimes don't really work that well until you've committed fully to that gag, and you go all the way through post. Like maybe there's a bunch of visual effects that are supporting that gag, or maybe the edit isn't quite massaged yet, or maybe it really needs, you really need the score to come in and manage the tone of that scene to make it work, you know?
You know, that reminds me of like, you know, when you're doing comedy, especially improv, you know, is no matter how stupid it is that you're doing, and if it's not getting any response, you just go even further. You just keep committing. And that sounds like that's not what's happening on that end, you know, at least on the production. They're like, they're chickening out halfway through. Because like committing, you will never get the joke if you never commit to it.
Right.
Or whatever. You won't get the action scene if you don't absolutely commit to it.
But imagine doing an improv scene on stage where you had weeks and weeks and weeks to nitpick and worry every little decision. That's what it's like. And if you don't have a team that has confidence in the people who are actually doing the work, then you start getting these sort of waffling decisions.
All of these productions.
Which
nobody has confidence in anybody.
They run to the fallback position all the time. And I think with the Sharknado, Sharktopus a little bit, I can't speak definitively, but I think witnessing around is around what's going on around it is that the studios that are making the movies must have the rings themselves, or the money they're getting from the network is less. So their influence is more on the movie. And especially if you want something at this budget range, the studio saying, production company saying, we're going to do it like this because we can afford to do it like this. Now the network is getting a discount as far as they're concerned, oh, because we only have to match X number of dollars instead of X times two, and you guys can give us something that's going to get the same ratings or better.
Right.
So I think that's why we are seeing some of the things evolve into just the ultimate camp, the ultimate, you know, Sharknado 3 now, right? And Sharktopus 3, maybe 4 is going on.
And getting, yeah. I don't know if they're getting A-list, but they're getting named people in these things.
Yeah,
now.
It's fun to do.
You're right.
No, I haven't seen any of the Sharknados, but when I first started seeing the sci-fi movies, it struck me that, you know, they're bad in a lot of ways, but they could be. They never quite managed to be hilariously bad, like just so much fun that you want to have a party and watch this movie and just like, oh my god, this is hilarious. You know, it doesn't have to be good; it just has to be a good time. And when they did Sharktopus, I felt like, okay, now they're kind of getting it. They're going over the top, and now it's going to be fun. And they didn't quite, like, it was there in concept,
right,
and they went with the concept, but the execution still had that kind of, like, neither fish nor fowl.
Yeah, it doesn't go into the Zucker Brothers territory at all.
And
it's not even brushing up against it, and it really needs to go for it, you know?
See, and I think that's the interesting thing, because I think camp occurs because somebody, you know, was honestly trying to go for something and just missed woefully. And it became camp accidentally. And I think that's if you think about it, that's kind of a small target to hit. Because if you go so far, then now you're just making a comedy. You're making a Zucker Brothers thing, you know. So now you're just making a comedy with visual effects in it, as opposed to we're going to make a serious kind of low budget action movie. You know, it's a surprisingly small target to hit that weird camp cult thing, you know? At least it seems to me.
You know? Yeah. What you end up with instead is something just mildly embarrassing to watch.
or not interesting or not campy enough to not flip past it.
Right.
You know, it's like,
Right. Like Army of Darkness would be still small budget overall, but theatrical release and now it's a cult classic. I think it hits that camp note for me.
But
I think just about perfectly.
But that's,
it doesn't maybe hold up so much, but I think it's you know, funny for all the right reasons.
There's there's a lot of flair going on in there in terms of the visual style and the editing and all of it. You know, it's very over the top.
That's Sam Raimi, right?
That's Sam Raimi, yeah.
So it's got like a really solid director behind it, smart guy.
Yeah. Yeah, I haven't seen it in years, but someone just pulled up a clip of Ash fighting the Deadites in the pit.
Right.
Because I remember loving Evil Dead 2 and thinking Army of Darkness was good, but not quite Evil Dead 2 good.
Oh, yeah.
And
too good.
Too good. And so, but just seeing the scene in the pit, I'm like, that is pretty badass.
See, I've got to cheese out. I've not seen any of them.
I've only seen
clips. What?
Too serious.
What makes you think you can do a podcast?
Jeez. I thought we were talking about French New Wave cinema, are we not?
Yeah.
Jeez, I hope not.
We're talking about Truffaut?
I haven't seen Truffaut.
Oh, it's like... Yeah.
I've seen his stand-up routine, but...
It's excellent.
Yeah,
he saw his little... he did that little cameo in... what was that?
Close.
The alien movie?
Yeah, that thing about...
People heard about it.
Yeah.
Aliens come down.
It's like
eat
E.T.,
Richard,
right?
Dreyfus. Don't they eat Richard Dreyfus?
Yeah. It's like invaders from E.T., I think is what it's
Do they
called.
Go through a wormhole to get there?
They do. As a matter of fact, can you show us how that wormhole works?
Oh, yeah. You take a piece of paper.
Wait, are they folding space?
Yeah.
Wait, how is a piece of paper like... We were just talking before you guys showed up. about how the stupid it's even in Interstellar.
It's in Interstellar and what's the other
Event Horizon?
Event Horizon. That's what it is. About oh shit, I'm bleeding.
Huh.
Mm, that's how good this podcast is.
Wow.
That's razor sharp podcast.
That's right. So this is why you should use chapstick and not sandpaper.
Oh.
So yeah.
We'll call the medic.
Deal
we have the on-staff
medic. Yeah, is this thing bonded? Are we fucked? I'll be over here bleeding, carrying.
Oh,
yeah. Amongst yourself.
So, Event Horizon. Yes,
the wormhole.
The two holes through the folded piece of paper to show us how we bent space, and therefore here we are doing a podcast.
That doesn't.
That's right.
But
this would have not happened if we not had pencil.
It shows the idea, but it doesn't show how you do it.
It doesn't. And it's like, I feel like it's this weird thing, like, back in the days of Jules Verne, because I was there, nobody felt like they had to explain shit. It's like, what's that do? It's the magic crystal. Good. We got it. We're going to try time travel. Now it's like, you see, when you have, like, you know, they're trying to validate the idea of why there's dinosaurs running around eating people. It's like, I don't need one.
Yeah.
You've got dinosaurs. I don't care. You know, or throw me enough, you know, but I don't think the dinosaurs showed up because of a pencil and a piece of paper.
Heisenberg compensators. How do those work? Very well. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it was nice that in Back to the Future, Doc Brown never explained how the flux capacitor worked.
Right. Do you want to know how it worked?
Actually, I wrote a paper on how it worked.
And you folded it in half.
Yeah.
And then you drove a pencil through it.
Yeah, right. No, he used a straw because the straw was key.
And then you drove a stake through the franchise with the second one.
Right.
Oh.
We're just talking about, I just tried to watch that the other day. I was telling you guys that. You can't watch it.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't quite work.
And you know what's weird is like, and I mentioned this the other day, but like so the hoverboards, right? You can buy toys that look better than those hoverboards. Those hoverboards look like shit. It literally looks like somebody went out and bought wood glue and like, probably what they did. I'm sorry, if you're listening to this and you made those props, I'm sorry. They look great.
They're Mattel.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So now you got Mattel.
The list of people not sponsoring this.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you, Mattel. Off the list.
Okay. Exactly. Oh,
well, yeah. The little toy versions of us, not going to happen. That's not right. Mattel. Yeah,
not even bobblehead. Did you have some stuff that you wanted to jump to?
Oh, I do have two scribbles on this sheet of paper.
I had a couple things to throw out if you guys wanted to talk about them. One was, do you guys want to talk about the Weta video?
Okay, I should just jump in and say that I didn't watch the video.
You didn't watch it?
I didn't watch it. What I did was I heard about it, and then you know how you can play most of these videos? They've got like graphics on screen now, so you can just watch it on Facebook without turning on the sound.
Right.
So I watched it that way.
That's how I composite.
Yeah. So I didn't hear what the dude was actually saying. I just saw his sort of comparisons. I saw that he was sort of pointing to IMDb scores of different movies. I assume to make points about whether or not they're good.
Well, he actually there's a theory in there. Do you want to describe the theory?
Yeah, the theory is that visual effects, CG effects in particular, in movies peaked at a time when you could not augment everything with CG. So the Incredible Hulk with the glowing green skin, Ang Lee version, he actually cited that as a better example than the current Hulk, or actually the newer one, Ed Norton Hulk.
Right, yeah.
Because you can relate to the environments that he was placed within. So he was in a broad daylight city street. He's the glowing green comic book Hulk, but it's a little more believable, a little more grounded. And in the newer Hulk, the Hulk looks great. He's got subsurface scattering. His skin looks like skin. His hair moves like hair. And yet around him, the whole world is in chaos. It's exploding. There's sparks. There's smoke. And there's all this reference that you don't have in your daily experience anymore. So there's nothing grounding anything to anything. And therefore, you are not able to get into the movie on an emotional connection.
What's the overall point that he's making?
I think it really is boils down to the concept of suspension of disbelief. And I think at least what I got from the video was, so his concept is this, is that when you know you're looking at something false, it's clearly false, but it has a real world reference it's matched to. And like the lighting matches and stuff, there's an attempt to make it in that world. Something in your brain knows you're looking at something fake. For example, old footage of battleships from like, you know, the 50s and the 60s where they'd put them in a tank and they'd be to scale, but the wave size was wrong and the explosions were wrong. You know, clearly the scale was off. But there's something in your brain. It's like watching a puppet show. You know it's fake. You can tell it's fake. But your brain clicks off and goes, shit, I'll go with it. You know, and so you're in. Whereas when it's almost like the uncanny valley of realism, not just the eyes, but like the whole, at some point it's trying to be so real that there is no point of reference and you can't suspend your disbelief. It's like, it's actually holding almost like a gauze up to your eyes.
Okay. So is the overall point that this fellow making that CG is bad?
I don't think so. I didn't get, did you get it? Was he shitting on CG?
I think it's the movies are just have gone too far. It needs to be dialed back.
So was that the point that he was making? that the movies are going too far, or is he saying that we like practical effects versus digital ones?
I don't think he was taking a stance. I think he was really just, I think the point of the video was, you can't suspend your disbelief in the way that you used to when it was slightly false. I think that's what I took away from it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in Puppet Yoda versus CG Yoda, that example. But, you know, the thing is, as a storytelling mechanism, I think is kind of the subset, because you can totally get engrossed in an animated film. I thought
that's a good
Avatar
point.
Was largely successful in its 100% CG scenes because we're involved emotionally with their goals, their desires. And
the 14-year-old girl in me was involved in Avatar.
Right, right. And it, if I don't have a point of reference, I think it just held up in a believable enough way that I think it's still, for me, Avatar didn't bother me, is what I'm trying to say.
I find these kinds of arguments a little specious because...
What's specious?
I don't know. It's that movie where the girl is an alien.
Great movie.
And that wasn't CG.
Is Richard Dreyfuss in that one,
That's
too?
My point. Yeah, he's in everything. Yeah, he was the alien in the suit.
Okay, so go.
Got here on a wormhole.
Show me how. Those arguments always bug me because it feels like a layperson. I'm just going to say it, a layperson. Mm-hmm. Someone who does not work either in the industry or in visual effects, who is watching movies and bemoaning the state of my blockbuster films today, where everything is visual effects. And even the word CG or the term CG bugs me a bit because it stands for computer generated. And that suggests that computers are just doing all this work. And the fact is that hundreds and hundreds of really super talented artists, and we can relate because this is the industry we work in,
right,
are sitting in chairs for long hours every week, week in, week out, making these things happen. And it's extremely technical, and it requires an immense amount of craft. So, and the computers are certainly part of that, but they're not generating the images without these people. So that aside, it seems like the point that people like to make is that the problem is with the visual effects, that computer generated images are ruining movies, and I disagree wholeheartedly.
You know, I actually don't think he was hating on CG. I didn't get the impression he was hating on it. I think his argument was more nuanced than there's too much CG in movies. I don't think that was his argument. Although I should go back and watch it. I think his argument was a little more nuanced. It was more like, it's not the CG that's the problem. It's a contextual problem of how the CG is used in a scene. You know, so you see the slight nuance in there is like, he wasn't hating on CG as a thing.
Yeah.
You know, he was just saying it's in his opinion is more effective in certain circumstances than it is in other circumstances. And part of the explainer of that was the suspension of disbelief. So he was not hating on effects at all. I didn't get that, because he liked the Hulk and the Ang Lee Hulk. So,
but am I correct in that he was terming this phenomenon the Weta effect?
It's called. Yeah.
So
yeah.
The Weta effect means
it started with King Kong, right? Wasn't that his first?
It was more the fact that as the technologies increased, we were able to just keep adding detail after detail after detail until we are almost beyond realism because we don't have a reference that looks like that.
Oh, right.
So instead of solid green skin, now you have pockmarks and scars and the blood vessels under that layer of skin.
It truly looks like the actor now.
Right. Yeah. But the rest of the scene doesn't help hold up. I mean, and
do you have it up right now?
Well, actually, this is a slightly older article from Variety.
Avengers and Age of CG Overkill in Hollywood.
Magazine? Showbiz people?
Hmm.
The big whammy wow. Box office. Isn't that what they do? People are listening. They're like, I have no idea what you're talking about. Unless you've seen a cover of Variety, yes. Then you realize they do like these crazy headlines.
The Hollywood language.
Yeah.
You know, like anything in film.
So describe what you're looking at.
I'm looking at an image of Ultron from the latest Avengers film. Who I've heard a lot of people hate on his design. I saw the film. I liked Ultron I think, best when he was in his initial form, where he was basically like a broken puppet. And right. he didn't have a moving mouth or anything. He was just all...
Parts,
right. spilling oil. I mean, that was great, and it was creepy. And then when he made himself the Chrome Man, I became very distracted by what appeared to be flexible lips for a Chrome character to have.
Oh, right.
What appeared
Lots
to
of
be
articulation.
Yeah.
That is just for show.
I mean, right. there was like one or two close-ups where they tried to sell the fact that, oh, no, his mouth is a bunch of little parts that are moving. And I'm like, yeah. But even with that idea planted in my head, I still just see like stretchy, bendy lips.
And you know, for me, this brings up an even larger issue of, I mean, it's a comic book. So like you're going to bring a comic book into a real world. And now the new thing is to make that world as real as possible now that we can with all the CG, you know. But there's still an intellectual crossover because it's a cartoon or it's a comic book. You know, it's a comic book character that lives well in a certain rendering, you know, lives well in like a comic book style rendering. And then where you're going to translate into a three-dimensional object that lives in a real world that supposedly works in real physics and real, you know, an expectation is set of what people think that should look like, you know? And so when it's weird, it's breaking its own rules in a way, you know? It's like, well, what is it? Is it
if this really? Had been done in, you know, the early 90s or the late 80s, let's say, you know, when you had Lucas and Spielberg doing their thing, and you had all this money, but no CG.
Right.
So there would have been puppets and puppeteers aplenty. And this thing would have been a physical model. It would have looked like, maybe it would have looked like metal. It probably would have been designed differently. But the mouth probably would not have been articulated like a rubber puppet.
Right, exactly.
Or, you know, like...
It wouldn't have had soft edges. It would have been like chunks of metal moving around.
I mean, honestly, his mouth was more articulated than Yoda's in the original Star Wars films.
So which one did you buy more?
Which one? I prefer the puppet version of Yoda to the CG version
of
Yoda.
Okay, so why?
Well, for a number of reasons, but not just because the one is CG and one's a
puppet. No, that's what I'm curious about.
First of all, I didn't care for those prequel films, so it was hard to really get into Yoda in those contexts anyway.
You're the only person I've heard that didn't like those.
Yeah, I know I'm an outlier, but I'm okay with that. I'm okay with standing alone in those opinions.
I was standing alone with every other Star Wars fan.
Right. but it was also, you know, the fact that they had him bouncing around like a tick.
Right. There were no physics.
Like, doing
what
flips. Yeah, there was no physics, but there didn't have to be because he could use the Force to do all kinds of crazy nonsense, which I...
By the way, we should start something on this show that's called Gas Bladder.
Gas bladder.
Gas bladder is when you call bullshit on something because the rules are being made up on the fly in a movie.
Yeah.
Because they want to do something they think looks cool, but it has no grounding either in the story or in the world or the physics. And it's
like
just
like the Jurassic World trailer.
Oh, what was
to me, the Jurassic World trailer just kept adding nonsense upon nonsense. Like, we did something stupid, and then we did something stupider and bigger. Then we did something really dumb and made it even crazier.
I think, you know, it's interesting because that's kind of going, it's sort of splitting the, they're kind of like sniffing around the Sharknado counter with that, you know, but they're obviously, it's a giant movie. I find that exhausting. I do.
Well, yes.
I just find it exhausting. It's like, it's bigger, it's better, it's more. And that kind of, the movie's kind of about that actually, you know?
Yeah.
And I think, and I'm not hating on that. I'd like to see us come at it from a different direction. You know, I like big spectacle. I love that. You know, that's why I'm doing visual effects. You know? But I just feel like we come at it the same way every time. You know, maybe I'm just, you kids get off my lawn old. That could be it.
No, you are, but but your point.
I think we're actually in an era where it happens in a way that we don't, it doesn't make us so angry. I don't know, like Interstellar. Interstellar is full of spectacle. Gravity, full of spectacle.
Right.
We're not losing our minds. I mean, those are heavy CG masterpieces.
Right.
And we're not losing our minds about those. But there's also not like monsters running around.
Right. Exactly. Right.
Getting weirder and crazier and more over the top. And
those have a scientific basis. I mean, they're not trying to, they're not fantasy, they're science fiction.
But also, the visual effects were very much in service of the story. It wasn't just like, and the story takes this left turn and goes over here and does this crazy thing for a while we have all this spectacle, and, you know, it's going to support the story, but it's really just a set piece.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, and right, you know, Guardians of the Galaxy, I like that tons,
right.
You know, all the way through, was having a good time. Indiana Jones 4... Yeah. The wrong way to go about that. Set pieces. Stringing together set pieces versus a movie.
Exactly. And like, and for me too, I saw this term before called fan service. You know this term?
Mm-hmm.
To me, that's kind of prostitution. Like fan service. Because to me, that implies we don't give a shit. We know you're going to spend the money, so here's some pile of shit and come on in and spend. I think that's unfair. Because those people are fans because the original or a series of three or whatever, however many really good ones, they were out of the park. You knocked them out of the park. That's why they're fans. They're not fans because of spaceships. There's a shit ton of stuff out there with spaceships in it, you know? But like, and so for me, that the fan service thing is, it's really cynical. You know?
Okay, back up. Fan service in terms of what?
So fan service is like, just keep banging out more superhero movies without really trying to make a really solid one. Now, I think we're reading a critical whatever juncture at this point, because there's so much of it now, you kind of have to step up the game. And I think Joss did that with Avengers. I think when I saw, I was like, Avengers, for me, when I watched Avengers, like, that's the
guy who does it right.
That's right, because he understands character.
Because he's respecting the fans.
That's right, and it's
for all the time. He's not just like, I got to do this because the studio, well, maybe the studio does say it, but he's the guy who does it right, he does it tastefully, and he comes at it from a direction and that the fans will appreciate. It's like, I get why he did that.
Right.
As opposed to... let's get Thor's shirt off because the ladies are going to come to the movie.
Right. And you know, I read about that before I saw the movie. So when it came, I was like, all right, here it is. But like, it still worked within I thought it was a complete side thing.
It was.
Yeah.
Weird.
Yeah.
But I mean, it sounds like you were kind of zooming out even more where you're thinking fan service is in, we've got to make another Daredevil movie, TV show, because there's fans of that.
Right, or even there's yet another Spider-Man reboot.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Like, I think this is less fan service and more cashing in on an intellectual property that people already know. And you can say that whether it's a book or a pre-existing comic book franchise or rebooting another movie, like, say, Poltergeist or whatever, they're not making something new and original, not because they can't do that and make something awesome that people will really love. Or make a lot of money. I mean, Avatar came out of nowhere and made $1.5 billion.
Right.
So it's not like that can't happen. It's just, if you're going to spend $200 million plus just on production, then maybe another $100 million on advertising. If you're going to drop that kind of cash, you want to make sure that people already know about the movie. You don't have to teach them about it.
Yeah, you don't have to build the brand before you... Yeah.
You want to just remind them, hey, remember Spider-Man? We're doing it again, and this time it's slightly different.
Exactly. And who? Speaking of, who is...
Some child.
It's usually somebody they pluck out of Game of Thrones. It's usually whatever's hot now, and they just pluck that person out of there, and...
I thought Peter Parker was a teenager last I knew, and now,
I think they're going back to that.
Pre-teen.
Okay.
Maybe I'm the old man. Get off my lawn.
Get off my lawn.
He seems like he's really, really young.
Yeah.
Spider babies.
Spider babies.
Yeah.
It's like Muppet babies.
Exactly.
Spiders.
Right. Yeah.
So I was going to jump around too on while we were talking about practical effects and stuff. Let's talk about the Star Wars thing that they just showed at Comic-Con. With a little behind the scenes stuff.
Which they hammered the whole practical effects when we did things
in nicely with what we're talking about. You know, the sense is people are over CG'd at this point.
Yes, but
you know?
I think it's been boiled down to buzzwords at this point.
Right.
We're in buzzword territory where people are like, man, it's a CG.
Well, you know what's funny is like, it's like it's a practical Millennium Falcon. Yeah, surrounded by CG. What's the difference?
There's so much CG in the new Star Wars.
And
rightly so.
Right.
Because you could not do 90% of what they're doing with practical effects.
Oh, the one that we've talked about this, but the one that I was like, that's such a dumb CG gag. it turned out to be an actual practical thing, the robot, the meatball robot. I was like, and that totally won me over. And which is weird because I'm not crazy about it. I thought the design is kind of dumb. And then I was like, oh shit, that thing's real? Then I was like, I'm kind of in. I'm like, that's really inventive, you know? And that got my attention.
Well, JJ is certainly more of a practical guy than Lucas, you know? It was going to be more practical than the prequels were anyway. But I think JJ knew going into the Star Wars that he had to not only do what he would normally do, but he had to like really let everyone know.
Oh, right. Like it's marketing. It's part of the marketing.
It is absolutely part of making peace with all the people who are still skeptics.
Right. Well, the other thing too is it would kind of be sad if there were no practicals in it, because if you have all the original cast, you kind of want all the nostalgia back in. I kind of want the models back in. I kind of want that.
Oh, you know? Absolutely. Yeah. But I guarantee you they are not shooting models on strings blowing up. They're not doing all.
I saw some behind the scenes stuff.
I saw it too, dude. They're not going back to the way things were done
right
back in the day. And by the way, if you could somehow time travel back to, you know, Dennis Muren and those guys who are doing some of that stuff, painstaking stuff back in the day, and show them, hey, we can do it like this with a computer and you can have a lot more control.
Oh,
they would do it.
They did do it. It's ILM.
Right.
Lucas,
we're done.
That's
we're
exactly
not,
right. Yeah.
Lucas birthed, you know, he wanted to. He was the guy who wanted to make his whole movie digitally. I mean,
that's right.
He's
the guy that referred to shooting actors as getting more elements.
Well, if not literally, that is what
he did.
It looks
no, he
like.
Did. And yeah. Like the thing where he's moving people around on the bridge or the
dock. And by the way, audiences love it. They love the types of things that can be done now with visual effects, but they also hate the things that are being done with visual effects.
Because it's egregious. It's just
a matter of usage. It's a tool. It's a massively powerful tool. So massive that you can do entire movies without people on screen.
And it's also turned into a crutch.
It's a total crutch.
And that's one of the things that my bone to pick for a lot of the CG stuff is like, I mean, how much time have we spent cleaning up plates that, by the way, if you don't know what a plate is, a piece of film, piece of footage. but like, I mean, you know, painting out a C-stand, you know, that kind of stuff, you would have never have done that 30 years ago. You would just move the C-stand. It takes 2 seconds.
We've enabled things to be done that you could never do, like wire work, where before you had to
hide
the wire in the shot. So you just shoot it, and then when you look at it later, you don't see the wire.
Right.
Like, that's freaking magic right
it
there.
Is.
But it's also extremely limiting.
That's right.
In what you can pull off. And now we've opened up all these new possibilities with wire paint out. And that's wonderful. I think that's fantastic. What they did in Inception with wire work,
that's the high bar for wire work.
Amazing.
Yeah. Especially because it's surrounded by...
Oh yeah.
By sets, I'm like, I don't know what's going on there.
Every shot that you're shooting from a new, like, we're now upside down, now
right.
we're sideways, now, you know,
keep it moving.
It's all fantastic. But at the same time, we enable lazy or incompetent filmmaking.
Well, the other part of that too is the tools and labor, frankly, has gotten cheaper over the years. And so that was a very expensive tool set that you could only afford if you were a Lucas or a Spielberg or a Cameron. That has really become democratized now.
Right.
Like, you know, the joke of like looking up on YouTube and seeing, you know, like 15-year-olds in Australia banging out killer looking green screen stuff. I'm like, well, you know?
Well, to bring this in to a more personal level, since we do this craft, what are your favorite types of effects to work on?
Oh, that's
versus
an interesting question.
Your most hated. I mean, some are kind of obvious, but you know, like I guess for me, I like to work on invisible effects where nobody knows something happened unless it becomes obvious. Because I remember getting blown away watching the movie Contact with the tracking shot of the girl going to the medicine cabinet, running up the stairs and all that. And like suddenly I after the scene was over, I was like, I just saw an impossible shot.
Right. Exactly.
That was great.
Yeah.
They kind of did the new Precinct 13. Is that the movie? They did a kind of a little homage to that in the beginning of that movie too, the opening sequence, which I thought was extra cool. It's like I should be seeing a camera crew in that mirror, and instead I see his face.
Yeah. You know what's interesting is talking about that used to be a little bit of an arms race, like who could do the longest one take. And I mean, you can only do a 20-minute load of film, you know, and so I suppose you could do more, but that's the longest because it's usually, what, 11 minutes a load or 10 minutes a load. Mm-hmm. And, like, so the big one was The Player. They're like, that whole thing is one shot, one reel. Like, you know, the average, like, your iPhone can go longer than that, you know?
Right,
you can
right.
cut in a bunch of stuff, and it's like, okay.
Our GoPro here.
That's exactly right.
Recording this, whatever's going on. But, yeah, those are my favorite kind of shots, and those are also kind of the rarest that ever come across, I think.
Mm, truly invisible, yeah.
When does an invisible effect become just an elaborate paint-out? Because that's what those shots
are. That's exactly right, yeah.
But it was nobody's mistake. It was a design, it was supposed to happen, and it was for an effect. It wasn't because someone didn't just look through the viewfinder for a second and see that, oh yeah, there's a flag or a, yeah.
Right.
But, you know, cosmetic effects, I think, fall under their purview as well.
Oh, yeah.
But those are just difficult.
They are difficult.
You mean like fixing
making people skinnier and, you know, we've actually tried to work on a job where we made someone bigger and uglier. Which is
oh, really?
Interesting.
Hmm.
Yeah.
That's only in Hollywood. This is mm-hmm. the, you know, she's a nerd. How do you know? Because she's hot and has glasses, you know. you know, speaking, I won't name the actress, but there, then I'm sure this is true with multitudes of actresses. Is that a thing?
Sure.
But she was doing a show and she actually had the legal, whatever, the contractual right to sit in with the editor and pick shots.
Hmm.
The actor.
Right.
So the actor is editing the thing. And there's nothing wrong with that if it's the actor's thing. But the thing is, this actor was trying to maintain a certain image throughout the whole thing. And that was actually dictating the creative output.
Sure.
And so, like, and the thing is, like, I can't say too much. But this person has a contractual obligation to another company. And it's about maintaining a certain image. And so this person was doing double duty. Hmm. They were trying to make a show, but then at the same time, they were also trying to keep their image brand high so they could maintain this other contract. It was a mess.
Was Scientology involved?
You'd say too
actually,
much.
No. Yeah. Oh, wait. What's that knock on the door?
exactly. Yeah. This podcast is not, doesn't neither confirm
no,
nor deny.
It was no Scientology involved.
Okay. That's neither a shame nor good.
Right. Right. It's just interesting. It's interesting. It's a thing that's dictating a creative output for a show mm-hmm. that has nothing to do with the show.
Right.
So, but what's your favorite thing to work on?
My favorite thing to work on? Invisible effects can be a lot of fun. I love the long shots of Alfonso Cuarón, like the stuff he did in the Children of Men. Like that great shot in the car.
Oh yes.
Yeah, there's some really fun stuff there. I have to say I'm if I never see another shot that goes through a window.
Yes.
Again, I will die happy.
The one that drives me crazy, the first time I was like, really, we're doing this, is Panic Room, where we flew through the coffee pot handle.
Yeah.
And I'm like, dude, why are we flying through the coffee pot?
I think we actually went through a keyhole, too.
Oh, did we?
You start through a keyhole, a coffee mug, and
well, here's the thing.
Kitchen.
The key,
and,
here, at least the keyhole is thematically related to Panic Room. There's guys robbing it. You know, what's a coffee pot got to do with anything?
Well, you know, the beginning of Fight Club starts at in the brain on a neuron that is firing a fear response.
But that is at least thematically tied to the movie.
It is, but then we go throughout all the like ganglion and until we come out of a sweat pour along his nose.
There's a lot above the line. We got to fill space, you know, like a lot of people. I know what you mean. It's like it seems too much, but I would even argue it's like at least it's related to the movie.
It's related. It's also related stylistically to the movie because there's a lot of that kind of flair in the storytelling and the way it's told visually. So it worked there. Panic Room, maybe a little strange to start out that way. I didn't see the film. Does that sort of camera action happen through the rest of the film?
I don't remember.
There are a couple other shots. I know the guy who helped to orchestrate. I know a guy who did a lot of the previs on that, is what I'm trying to say. And yeah, there were a couple other shots that would have been impossible to plan for on the fly, motion control kind of things. And I think they had some kind of new I don't know, new at the time maybe, was like a full speed motion control kind of thing, I think.
Oh, really?
But there's another shot where it kind of spirals up, the camera spirals up the staircase and goes through the banister.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd only seen the movie once, but I do remember catching that. It's like that was all pre-vis.
The new toy. It's like, oh, we got a new toy. Let's make shots out of it. Yeah.
But I love working on creature effects. That is something that it's extremely difficult. And it's oftentimes done poorly on one level or another, and it's frustrating. The CG Yoda, I think they actually went back and replaced the puppet Yoda in the Phantom Menace. They had Frank Oz come in and do the puppet.
Oh, they did. Oh,
and then on some re-release of the film, they just said, well, we did CG for episodes 2 and 3, so we CG'd him. In one, I think that's correct.
Oh, interesting.
In any case, I didn't like the way he looked. I didn't like the way he was rendered. I didn't like the way he moved. I didn't like any of the scenes he was in.
Other than that, you're okay with him?
I loved it. So you know, he lacked really the gravitas and the story oomph and the wonder and all the wonderful things that made him special in the original films wasn't there. And then on top of that, I thought he looked weird.
He did look weird.
He moved weird. And now he's doing all kinds of things that I don't think he should be doing.
Right. So, right. He's not, he was the old, and granted, time has gone by, but he's an old man when we see him the first time. You know? And now he's like, he looks like an old man, but he's acting like, you know, an Olympic gymnast. You know, it's like, well, those don't go together. Like, make him look like a younger, truly younger version of Yoda. That's, you'd be like, oh, that's what Yoda actually looked like younger. Not like old Yoda but now doing...
How much younger? I mean, he's 800 years old. Well,
he's
750 years old now. He should be that much younger.
Didn't he look good? He's had some work done.
Yeah.
He's had a lot of work done. Really a lot good. Of CG work done.
But a lot of CG creatures, too, or a lot of CG work in general... like we were talking about the Hulk earlier, and to that point, I think maybe there's so much work that's done to make the thing look and feel real and in the world that folks are afraid to hide any of that work, to let it fall in shadow. Like they're looking for ways to kind of show off. Like,
yes,
we created all of these wrinkles.
That's right,
and now that we've got the subsurface scattering on and they're in the world, it's not reading. So let's really bump up that.
And this is real. This whole thing has been a thing since the beginning. I remember shots at Foundation. I remember throughout, you know. And I should say I'm largely a compositor. So if you don't know what a compositor is sort of the last person in the food chain, most usually. Maybe timings after that. But oftentimes, unless the 3D artist actually composites their own shots, a 3D artist will render out what are called passes, and then the compositor will put them together and dial them in. And it's always an interesting relationship because oftentimes, many times, mostly, the 3D person has a very clear idea of what they think it should look like. They should. They did the shot, unless you had a separate lighter and you know you have a large crew like at an ILM situation or whatever. But that's always an interesting conversation to have of, the 3D person spent a lot of time on it and they want their work to show, rightfully so. And then the compositor is stuck with that and a plate. And the plate is more lo-fi than you would think. Because it's live action, but this was more truer with film. Now that everything's 4K and 100K and whatever else we're going to, that'll be less of an issue because you won't have to dumb CG down to match the back plate,
right,
you know. So, but I have noticed that is... Like, if you just look at average photography, if you pointed your camera out that window, your brain thinks it sees more than it's actually seeing because you're filling in a lot. And I remember years ago, I'm spinning around a little bit here, but I remember back at Foundation, we brought, I'm not going to remember his name, but really sharp guy was sort of teaching us in-house how to deal with grain, film grain. And he had a great point. Now, keep in mind, this information is a little dated because it's old film stock, which, goodbye. But he was talking about if you zoom into any negative, even the latest, Kodak, whatever, the latest film available, if you zoom in 10 times, it's noise. It is noise. There is no detail there. And when you realize that, you realize the whole thing is pointillism. The whole thing. And so at what point, and CG is exactly the opposite of that. it's vectory, you know, it's very lines, you know, and so you're sort of meshing one thing to another thing, and so you can't smart up the plate, so you have to dumb down the CG, you know. So it's always a trick, and it's a trick too to also negotiate how much should be in there. And at some point, you tip the eye off, and the eye's like, that's not real. You know, it's pretty, but it's not real. You know, and that's also a thing. You could do just pretty. That's totally legit too. You know, but that's a thing. That's an interesting conversation that is always sort of in my mind. I'm trying to honor the 3D person, but I'm also responsible to try to make it match to the plate as close as possible. And of course, there's always time limitations and all that stuff. So,
yeah, and when, you know, in the old days, they would make models. You'd have miniatures as detailed as they could possibly make them. So they figure out what scale they need to make the thing as big as possible to get as much detail in there so that, you know, it looks like it matches the world of the shot. And then, but ultimately, at the end of the day, when you get close to those models, oftentimes the painted details, it starts to feel very impressionistic at a certain
point. That's right. Or even because, like matte paintings. You look at that. Yeah,
exactly. At a certain point, the detail breaks down and it's just blobs of paint, which is great because it's then going to be shot with a real physical lens and a real physical camera. And you're going to see how the light really reacts in the real world.
Right.
And you get all that wonderful stuff for free. And then it's just a matter of compositing it in a real way into your shot. Now we're with computer-generated images or VFX. We're trying to create those models with points and lines and JPEGs or whatever, you know, trying to kind of cobble it together. And it's going through with virtual lights into a virtual camera. And it's all just simulation.
And it's very hard to make a mistake. I mean, you can make plenty of mistakes. It's hard to... what am I trying to say? It's... When you're dabbing a paintbrush on a physical model, it's imperfect.
Happy accidents.
Happy accidents, exactly. And I guess that's harder to come by in CG, you know, because you can do it through texture, I suppose. It's hard to do that through geometry, or else you start breaking things.
There are no happy accidents.
Right.
It's at least the way the pipelines are designed right now, you have to be like...
You have to think it out.
So thought out, and everything is planned, and everything has intention. And then you do your best to make that look as real as you can.
Right.
And there's lots of ways. There's lots of ways it can go slightly wrong.
Right.
In terms of believability, but you just dial it in, and try to get it as close as you possibly can.
You know, one of the things I've been playing around with is a lot of like substance designer and these more modern things, because one of the issues is always like. Things look, I probably should save this for another podcast, but the idea of materials have different reflective natures and stuff like that. And for me, and you see this a lot with the modern game engines, that is all the difference.
Mm.
Like when you see, you know, image-based lighting on, you know, a really well-developed texture shader, it looks photoreal, mm-hmm. you know, that's a whole other, I can save that because that gets pretty technical. Audience, if you want to hear more of that, we can get into that. But
that's also that there's a very big difference when you're talking about something looking real in a game environment or something looking or feeling real in an animated movie versus something looking real once you plunk it into an actually photographed shot.
Oh, for sure. Yeah,
like you take that object out of the game and you plunk it into an actual shot, it becomes a much more challenging thing to make that to sell that as part of the shot.
I'm going to... Oh, did it die?
We lost the camera.
Oh, the GoPro.
That's totally... I had one job.
Can we do... we can finish the rest of like a puppet show or something.
I actually had two jobs. I'm also watching that. I dropped the ball.
What I was thinking about doing is throwing in my... answering your question. Maybe we should wrap up because we're at 2 hours now.
Did we actually do a two-hour podcast?
Yes, we did.
No, that's real one. 52 minutes.
Right. I want to apologize to everyone out there. Mom,
hey, we could cut out all the crap.
I gotta tell you,
thanks for listening.
They're not gonna hear this because they already tuned out. No,
right. Yeah, you can do that, and I do have which we could also probably save to the next one. But I do have an interesting flip flop to. I don't know if it's interesting. I have a flip flop story to what Ephraim was touching on.
It's good. Hold on, it's a cliffhanger.
Yeah, that's the cliffhanger.
That's good. So your answer.
So I tend to really enjoy stuff that also disappears because that to me is. That's in some ways a test of chops too, you know. You really get to see how well you can with the materials in front of you. Really try to make it disappear. I have a really quick story about trying to make something disappear. a great lesson in thinking backwards, actually, on doing a shot. And I was doing a shot for Prison Break. And it was one of, I think it was the pilot or first couple episodes or something. We were trying to figure out how to get the map on the guy's back. And they had the actor, you know, no shirt on, and he's, you know, he's being as still as he can, but you're back, it's your back, you're moving, you know, your muscles move and stuff like that. And the thing is, anybody can see when it slips, anybody. You can bring any, because it's so, everybody knows what a human being looks like, and everybody knows what a drawing looks like, and everybody has seen a zillion tattoos at this point. So, like, you can tell if it's not attached to his back, it doesn't look like a tattoo, it was supposed to look like a tattoo. So I took a crack at it. I couldn't get it. Another compositor took a crack at it. I think Patty took it in the flame, or Steve took it in the flame. Couldn't get it. This is all back at Zoic. And I can't remember. I should give credit to whoever did figure it out. I don't remember who did. But here was the solution. Get rid of the guy's back. And I didn't know that. I mean, I know that now. It's been years ago. But I was like, that's so counterintuitive, because you spend so much muscle trying to get that thing on the guy's back and trying to track it and mesh warp it. And you realize, it will never match.
When you say get rid of his back, you mean you took a still of his back?
Took a still of his back and tracked it in.
Yeah.
And it was invisible. Because now at that point, you have a still on top of a still. Mm-hmm. And you're covering up his back. So you have removed the reference that's giving it away that it's bad. Right. You know? And so, like, that to me was like, that always sticks in my mind of, like, that's also the fun part of visual effects, is, like, the solution is not always what you think it is. Yeah. You know, it's counterintuitive to cut out the guy's back and make that
right. Because all the tools and marketing and everything shows you people doing that kind of thing seamlessly in their little YouTube sizzle reels. You know? It's like, we have a tracker that's got 9 points of, and then, yeah. So yeah, you think, I'm going to use that tool. I'm going to track something.
It never works.
No.
It's always about tricking the eye. At the end of the day, it's about knowing what's going to give it away and working around that thing. There was a great behind the scenes on the first Lord of the Rings movie, where it was just a helicopter shot. The Fellowship, they're walking along on a mountaintop, some grassy, you know, mountaintop, and they wanted to put this little piece of ruins that they're just walking by, right?
Oh, right.
So CG ruins, and that's it, just this one shot. And the helicopter shot, they had the information there, they had tracked it, it should work, but every time you could see it just wasn't sticking to the mountain, it was slipping, and they could not make it work no matter what they did. So they finally just basically projected some of that mountain onto a piece of geometry,
yep.
And then where the stone connected with the mountain looked perfect, and then they were able to just feather it off into the grass, and you never knew to look there.
Right, exactly.
You know what I mean?
That's
so it's about knowing where your eye's going to go and tricking it. So are we teasing your story, PJ, for another podcast?
Yeah, let's tease that one.
So that it's a flip-flop to the what now? Let's tease it. Let's tease it properly.
It's a flip-flop to the wanting to show every detail in a critter.
Mm.
Like,
oh,
you make
good.
Your movie creature, and they're like, oh, yeah, we got to show off all that stuff.
We should... That's also a philosophical question, too. We should get into that.
Philosophical... The philosophy of creatures
or
in movies?
Or just...
Why are they so hungry?
That and
do they have to eat everybody? Gee.
And then also, what is our job? Is our job to make it pretty for us? Is our job to make it believable for somebody else, you know, or both?
Or is our job
butts in seats?
Our job is to support the story.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
I'm sorry. That was some crazy talk.
All right, well, you want to wrap it up?
Yes, let's wrap it up.
All right, gang, well, we will see you next time. Thanks for listening.
10 Giant Robots is created and distributed by the 10 Giant Robots Radio Network in beautiful downtown Burbank, California. Our theme music was created by the incredibly talented Shane Knight. Follow us on Twitter at 10 Giant Robots or at 10giantrobots.com.